This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, John Burns, is the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. He was based in Baghdad in the months leading up to the war, remained there during the bombing, and left at the beginning of May. Early this month, he returned to Iraq, but he's in New York today to accept a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. As we'll hear, he's taken great risks to report from Iraq. Burns has won two Pulitzer Prizes for his work in war zones, covering Bosnia in 93 and reporting on the Taliban in 97. I spoke with John Burns this morning. Let's start with today's front page story that you wrote about a seeming lapse in American surveillance that led to the looting of radioactive capsules from one of Saddam Hussein's old battlefield testing sites in the desert. What are these radioactive capsules?
Well, they've been known about for a long time because, of course, the world was investigating Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and his attempts to develop them, over 20 years, in effect. This site, it's about 35 miles southwest of Baghdad in the heart of the so-called Sunni Triangle, which complicates the whole story because of the hostilities for American troops in the area, was used certainly in the 80s. Probably less so in the 90s, once its existence became known to the United Nations monitors, to simulate battlefield conditions for nuclear, chemical, and biological warfare. So it was actually part of its WMD program. And as part of that, they had these 8 75-foot-high steel towers, about 3 feet across at the base, rooted in concrete plinths, in which they had cobalt-60 capsules, which were raised into the towers so that they could irradiate the area. When American troops arrived in the area this April, a WMD unit of the American forces went and looked at this place and found that the capsules were still there and still active and therefore potentially dangerous. What's happened since then is that with only 130,000 troops in Iraq, the American forces have been pretty stretched thin, and as far as we can understand it, the surveillance of this area was done by remote high-technology means, which I think means satellites. There was a delay in interpreting satellite pictures, which resulted in these towers being looted, 3 of them actually being pulled down, 2 of the Cobalt-60 capsules being looted with them into neighboring villages. And the downstream consequences of this are that there are at least 2 cases of radiation sickness, and that most of the men, we don't know how many, who actually cut the towers down, transported them to the villages along with the capsules, have disappeared, and the villages are refusing to say where they are or even if they're alive or dead. So, it's going to be a difficult problem to resolve. But once the lapse in surveillance was discovered, you have to say that the American forces and the Defense Threat Reduction Agency went into high gear and have done everything possible to mitigate the problem.
You think one possible use of these capsules during the Saddam Hussein regime was using them to test the effects of radiation on the human body?
Yeah, well, that was much reported, that he was doing this at one or other sites, his battlefield testing sites, back as far longer as the 1980s. What we discovered when the New York Times, myself and a photographer and our Iraqi helpers, went into this battlefield testing zone a couple of times in the last few days, we went to some of the wrecked buildings that have been looted. Some of them were bombed by the United States in 91 and again earlier this year. We found in the rubble of one of the buildings sand-covered documents amid the rubble and strips of celluloid film. The film showed pictures, close-up, of men facing the camera, apparently alive, naked torsos, their heads, etc. Some pictures, as I recall, of animals. Very difficult to see these things because of the deterioration. The documents were filled with illustrations indicating that there had been, it seemed to me, human and animal tests. It's all in Arabic, and we're working through them right now to see exactly what they mean. The American forces are aware that there are these documents. Of course, they're very interested to know exactly what happened at that site. But when you stand there in front of those towers in this desolate wasteland with the wrecks of tanks and armored personnel carriers, Iraqi ones that were placed there, and there's a grim-looking reviewing stand set several hundred yards back from the site, it's difficult to imagine that the area was used for anything other than tests on human beings.
Now, you write in your front page story today in the Times that the looting of these nuclear capsules seems likely to become a parable for much of the nature of the American occupation. What do you mean by that?
I mean that the American forces are faced with an extremely difficult, if not impossible, task. The American force is now limited to 130,000 men. This is a country of 25 million people, as big as France. It's extremely difficult to cover everything, and that's been a problem from the start. So just as the surveillance of this site appears to have failed to pick up the looting early enough to prevent these capsules being taken and the radiation sickness that has resulted, so there are many other things that the American forces in Iraq simply cannot get to. One of the things they have to do, of course, is protect themselves. It's the first task of any commander. Force protection in a situation where you're being attacked on every expressway and in every dusty alley and every town. It's an exaggeration because we can talk about that later, but in any, it's an extremely dangerous environment, limits what they can do. They're under attack. There are, of course, occasionally mistakes made. The intentions, I think, are good. And much good is being accomplished. But the balance sheet, as seen from America, of course, is a close-run thing. There's much good that's being done. There's much much ill that is ill to report, principally for America, of course, the heavy casualties there. And I just saw this as another piece of that much wider picture.
You say that some defense officials who asked to remain anonymous told you that this showed the Bush administration's error in sending too few troops to secure Iraq. What are some of the other things that defense officials have been telling you off the record? I mean, not off the record, I mean under anonymity.
Well, I have to say, there's not a lot of difference between what is said publicly and what is said privately. First of all, unlike, I think, certainly in the latter stages of Vietnam, I don't detect in the American forces at any level of responsibility much question about the mission. I think there are serious worries about where the mission is going to go. I think there are acute anxieties about the casualties that are being taken. But when they talk to us about issues like that, there's troop levels, of course. It's in the face of the insistence of the commanders in Iraq, Lieutenant General Sanchez, Ricardo Sanchez, the present commander, has said, as his predecessor, General McKinney, did, that they have enough troops for the mission. I think that has to be understood in the context of how it came about that there was such a relatively small force deployed there. As I understand it, it's not something I report on, but the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, taking somewhat his lead from what happened in Afghanistan, believed this was doable with high-tech means and local support, fast-moving special forces teams and so forth. And the war was a tremendous success in that sense. I mean, it took, 21 days to reach Baghdad. The casualties were, relative to other wars that America has fought, relatively low. It was a success, but I think, and it surely is common cause now, that to fight a war with a lean army of that kind is one thing. To make a peace with it is another. Whilst the insistence is we have enough troops for the mission, I think a lot of American officers and certainly a lot of the troops would feel safer and more sure of success in the mission if there were more boots on the ground.
You covered the bombing of Iraq. You were in Iraq for several months before the bombing. You left in early May, and you returned again in November. What are your impressions of how Iraq has changed from before the war?
Well, I think it would be honest to say that many of us who had experienced, I mean, in the sense that you can, without actually being the victim of it, the repression of Saddam Hussein, who had lived in that ghastly, benighted country in the face of the bloodbath that he had carried out over a period of 24 or 5 years, came to the conclusion that if it could be ended, it should be ended for the sake of the Iraqi people. Now, I'm not in the business of advocacy. The brutality was palpable. America had its other reasons for doing this. But I think that we felt that the scenes that all Americans saw on April the 9th, when the statue came down of jubilation, were absolutely a true reflection of the way that the overwhelming majority of Iraqi people felt. So to go back months later and find that the enterprise has become so complex, so difficult, and so costly in terms of American and Iraqi lives, to find Iraq a less safe country by a long way to move about in for people like myself, indeed for everybody, and especially the American troops, is a very dispiriting thing. And, of course, you ask yourself the questions that I suppose the overwhelming majority of Americans are asking, which is, you know, is the price too high? And only time will tell that. But I think it's fair to say that even Iraqis who now clamor in protest outside American military facilities, if you go in amongst the crowds, even at truck bombing sites, and you ask them for their bottom line when all of the clamor is spent and say, look, we are messengers. Do you want us to pass the message back to America that the troops should go home now? The overwhelming response is once people feel safe, this is very important, Saddam Hussein is still about. And so you have to try and understand the context in which these people are talking. And you'll have a conversation which begins with people saying, Americans go home, Saddam, 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 etc. But if you talk long enough, as they grow more confident that you're not from the CIA, that you're not a partisan, then the truths become coming out. And the bottom line is, we don't want American troops to go. They're not very comfortable about the rapid handover of sovereignty because they're afraid that could descend into chaos. And that message is quite insistent, and I think the American public should know that, whether the American public now has to make its own decision on its bottom line. After all, it's America that's paying a very high price here. Is America feel that it wants to persist with this? That's a wholly different question, which I'm not in a position to answer since I work in the distant world.
My guest is John Burns, the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. We'll talk more about Iraq after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Burns is my guest. He's chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He's covering Iraq. He's in New York very briefly to accept this evening an award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. You were staying at the Palestine Hotel, which was where one of the two hotels that was struck last week by rocket launchers hidden on donkey carts. Were you in the Palestine during the attacks?
I was. It occurred at 7:15 in the morning. And let me set the scene very quickly. The Palestine and Sheraton hotels, where we spent the war, have become one of the principal facilities for the occupation, in the sense that not only journalists are staying there, but they are outnumbered now by people who are working for reconstruction agencies like Halliburton, Kellogg Brown, Root, and, although it's difficult to say who exactly they are, a large number of American civilians who are heavily secured within the hotels. I think that your listeners can probably make a guess as to which agencies some of these people represent. So these are endangered facilities, and they have surrounded them with 20-foot-high concrete blast walls. And you look down from your balcony on the Palestine, and you're constantly looking for weak points in those barriers. And there is a weak point, which I don't need to go into, but it leaves me a little concerned about whether or not the hotels are completely secured against truck bombing. So, 7:15 on Friday morning, I was just waking for the day, and there was the most horrendous, satanic explosion, and my room filled with heavy smoke, grime. The whole building shuddered for minutes. I assumed it was a truck bomb, and to tell you the truth, I thought I should have listened to others. Everybody said the Palestine is unacceptably dangerous. I went there because where I spent the war, I feel comfortable. The staff are very friendly to me. It's my home in Baghdad. When I got out into the corridor and was able to see, what I saw was that one of these rockets, which is a battlefield rocket, it's got a range of about 10 miles. It has a pretty heavy warhead on it. And they're designed to hit troop concentrations and tanks and things of that kind. One of these rockets off the donkey cart, which was placed perhaps 200 meters away from the point of impact, had entered the hotel about 40 feet away from the room on the 16th floor where I was abed at the time.
You were on the 16th floor?
Yes, I was, yeah. So It was a serious wake-up call. I'd been in the hotel in April, I think it was April the 7th, when an American tank shell hit about 70 feet away from where I was at that time. And I don't want to waste your time or the time of your listeners with my children would call my sermons about how journalists are not heroes. That's not my point in telling stories like this. We choose to be where in those places. The rewards for us, in very personal terms, are pretty high in terms of being where the story is. I chose to be in that hotel. Now, some people would say that's a warning. Surely if it happens twice, it's time to go elsewhere or consider a different line of work. I would say, and I hope this isn't seen as being a conceit, but I would say that if it happens twice, the chances of it happening a third time statistically are overwhelmingly against. And in any event, it's not just being the Palestine Hotel, it's being in Iraq that's dangerous. It's simply the most dangerous environment for journalists, as it is for all foreigners, Westerners, that I have ever seen by a very, very long margin. I was not in Vietnam, so I can't speak to that. But in a career of 30 years and more as a foreign correspondent, I've never seen anything approachably as dangerous as this. And there aren't a lot of things you can do to make it safe. And I think we better prepare ourselves in our profession, my profession, for bad news.
You've written a little bit about the dangers of travel now in Iraq, and you've described how even the turboprop plane landing at the airport has to take special precautions against surface-to-air missiles. Would you describe what it's like just to land at the airport now?
Well, all flights have now been canceled for the period because DHL cargo flight going to Baghdad Airport was hit by a surface-to-air SAM-7 missile on Saturday. So now the in and out is by road, 1,000 kilometers across the desert. I think personally that's more dangerous because it takes you through the badlands of the Sunni Triangle. I would prefer to fly, and flying in is an interesting experience. You come in over Baghdad at 19,500 feet in a twin turboprop aircraft, which takes three wide circles as it comes down into the airport. So you're exposed below the 15,000-foot ceiling of the SAM-7's range for quite a long time as you come down. And you just look down on those southwestern suburbs of Baghdad and the desert stretches that lie beyond, which are many of them Sunni areas, including the area around Abu Ghraib, where the notorious prison was. And you think, is there somebody down there in a palm grove with a shoulder-fired missile? Now, we don't know what precautions the United States military are taking. There are many things that they can do, and I no doubt do. But we know from the incident on Saturday that whatever they do, there's still a significant risk of a missile being fired. And again, there are no exemptions. The flights that we take, it's Royal Jordanian Airlines, it's a civilian aircraft. There are no, as far as I know, military people on those aircraft. I don't think that matters one little bit to the fellow down there in the palm grove. I think all he sees is a sort of talisman of the foreign occupation.
It sounds like you think Iraq is more dangerous now than it was during the bombing.
Oh, yes, I've no doubt about that, and I don't think that any of my colleagues would dissent from that. You know, there may have been and probably were mistakes made in the targeting of the cruise missiles and bombs, but they were relatively few. I think that even critics of the war have to concede that the American aerial attack on Baghdad was done with extraordinary, extraordinary precision. So you know, you could stand on the balcony of the Palestine and watch this extraordinary fireworks display every night. I don't want to be flippant about it because people were dying under those missiles and bombs, but you could watch this every night with, I felt, reasonable security that cruise missile that you saw coming up the river was not going to hit you.
What indications do you have, if any, about who is behind the insurgency?
Well, of course, you know, with the American military command is saying that the big deficiency is not numbers of troops, but intelligence. And it's getting better, but it's going to take a very long time to... Remember, Saddam Hussein and his people came out of a clandestine background. Saddam Hussein started as an assassin on the streets of Baghdad back in 1959 or thereabouts. They're very good at this kind of thing. He used to move around, so we're told, when he was in power, sometimes in the back of taxis, alone. to evade American detection. He's very, very good at this. So to say we don't know exactly who's doing this is one thing. To presume that Saddam and Izzat Ibrahim al-Duri, his number two, and other acolytes are somewhere in that mix and probably right at the heart of it is not hard. You might ask yourself, who else would be directing this? The attackers are overwhelmingly Iraqis. The American command says there may be 200 foreign fighters there. And the methods that are being used are so brutal that you have to think, you know, who is there about who is that brutal? Well, the answer is Saddam Hussein is that brutal.
John Burns is the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. He's now based in Iraq. Tonight he receives the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter John Burns, chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He was based in Iraq in the months leading up to the war and covered Baghdad during the bombing. He returned to Iraq early this month, but he's briefly in New York, where tonight he will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Although he's risked his life to report from war zones, Burns insists he doesn't want to glorify journalists or pass himself off as a hero. I ask you this not to try to make you into a hero against your will, but rather just to get a sense of the environment now in Iraq. While reporting from Baghdad or in thereabouts, you narrowly escaped six thieves with Kalashnikovs on the highway. It sounds like this is a fairly typical experience.
The Ali Baba, as they are called. My sense of ancient Arab myth and folklore is a little shaky here. But Ali Baba was a Baghdadi, and he was. Some say he was a thief. Some say he wasn't a thief. But in any event, that's why these chaps are called Ali Babas. Robbing the foreigner is a big industry now, out in the tribal lands of Iraq. So any journey between the cities, and indeed some journeys inside the cities, is fraught with the risk of coming across these people. Only rarely have they opened fire and wounded or killed anybody. Generally speaking, what they want is they want your equipment, they want your money. But you can never be sure, and in my case, I was on my way to the bombing of the Italian military police compound, the Carabinieri compound, 10 days ago now, I think, in Nasiriyah in the south. And we had to run into the dark to get there. We knew it was dangerous. We didn't pass another vehicle, didn't see another vehicle for about a half an hour before this incident happened. And then out of the desert on either side of the road, suddenly about 200-300 yards ahead of us came these men. It took me an instant or two to realize what it was all about. They had masks on. Three from the right, three from the left, and turned their Kalashnikovs directly at us. Now, had I been driving, I would have slowed, and I think I would have made my imprecations to Allah. Our driver, a former Iraqi tank officer, a brave guy, smart guy, hardened by years of a war, of the Iran-Iraq war, in a trice, I mean literally before I could have even registered it, got the lights off. We were already traveling about 100 miles an hour. In a four-wheel drive vehicle, and gunned the engine up to about 120 miles an hour, swung leftwards onto the side of the road at the three on the left, and then swerved right at the three on the right. And they jumped backwards, and we shot forward into the night and traveled for about 10 minutes after that with our lights off. And, you know, would we have done better to stop and give them whatever dollars we had and give them our computers and satellite phones? Should we thank the driver for our lives? We'll never know. On the whole, I think it's probably better in circumstances like that to keep going if you can keep going, because there's no way you can know at which point Alibabaism becomes politically motivated, and I suspect that the line is a pretty narrow one. There may very well be people who are robbing who will catch the spirit of the times as they see it and who will then move on to killing. In the end, I think that you praise the Lord and just hope, and I'm not a particularly religious person, so I'm using that as a metaphor. I think that you just hope that your luck is going to hold.
Your luck started running out, actually, under the Saddam Hussein regime. You found out in early May that the regime considered you basically the most dangerous journalist in Iraq because you had written very critically for several months about the Saddam Hussein regime. Two people broke into your room, I think it was two people, at the Palestine Hotel. Five people, excuse me. On April 1st, warning you that if you didn't kind of follow what they wanted you to do, they'd imprison you. What did they tell you?
Well, I had returned. Getting visas was very difficult to get back into Iraq, and I was on a blacklist, but I got in about 2-3 weeks before the war. I'd been in intermittently over the previous year, but I got back. I knew I was an endangered person. The Director General of Information had taken, whenever he saw me at news conferences, briefings, restaurants, to saying mirthlessly with a pointed finger, "There's the most dangerous man in Iraq." And I had said to him on a number of occasions in front of my colleagues, "Now let's see if we can understand this. That is either a warning or it's a bad joke. I'm going to treat it as a bad joke until you tell me that you have the intent to injure me in some way." So it was a close call as to whether to stay or go. In the end, I stayed, but they'd had a man who I knew to be a very senior official of the Mukhabarat, the secret intelligence service of Saddam Hussein, assigned as my minder, a very nasty piece of work indeed. He predictably disappeared when the cruise missiles started flying. These people are always and everywhere cowards. And I didn't see him again until the night of April the 1st, something like 2 o'clock in the morning, when they burst into my room. There was no light in the hotel. We were working by candles. He said, "You're under arrest. We know that you work for the CIA. We are going to take you to a place from which you will not return." They then started gathering up all of my equipment. And then the most encouraging thing was they started looting. They started taking all the food that I had, and there were boxes of things called Smarties. They're sort of a British M&M. And there was a kind of thrusting into this box for these things. And I began to think, well, you know, are they going to take me away to some hard place, or are they just looting? I said to this man, his name was Saad Multana, leather jacket. I said to him, "Listen, you know, you call yourself an intelligence official. There's nothing very intelligent about what you're doing, because if you think that the United States would employ somebody as indiscreet as me as an agent in a place like this, you're very foolish. That's the first thing. But assuming that you were right, Mr. Multana, then you'd have to think, with American troops less than 100 miles away from Baghdad, that if you do anything that harms me, that you'll end up in front of an American military tribunal. And you may very well end up at the end of a rope yourself. So you have to ask yourself, does this make sense, just from your own point of view?" And there was a lot of shouting and nastiness. And then he said he was going to go away and talk to people. And he left. These thugs who accompanied him stayed for about 20 minutes. And then they went out into the corridor saying, "You stay here." And nobody came back for about 10 or 15 minutes, and I realized if I stay here, and they are, in fact, intending to take me away to some very unpleasant place, I'm done for. So I better try and get out. And I did what anybody who went to an English boarding school did. It took me about 3 or 4 minutes just to turn the handle on the inside of my hotel room door to try and get it open without making any noise. And I looked down the corridor. Iraqis smoke by the overwhelming majority, and I thought that if these people are mounting guard, I'll see a cigarette butt burning in the dark. I couldn't see anything, so I dashed for the fire stairwell and went down from the 16th floor. And I didn't really know what I was going to do, but to cut a long story short, I went into hiding, protected by other journalists, for as long as the war continued. And I have never seen Mr. Saad Multana again, but as you can imagine, I would like to have a conversation with him.
How did you work? They'd confiscated your computer, they'd confiscated your satellite phone, and you couldn't show your face. So how did you get any work done?
Well, you have to remember that the American troops, notwithstanding the information minister's increasingly comical performances on the mezzanine roof of the Palestine Hotel, saying that, you know, we're routing the Americans, we're killing them by the thousands, there isn't an American soldier in Baghdad. This when, as we could see American tanks cross the river 800 yards away in the Republican Palace. That, notwithstanding that foolishness, people had begun to recalculate by that time. Power had shifted, in effect. substantially by a week before the Americans arrived. So I knew that there were people in the information ministry and the Mohabarat who were not going to go after me, whoever may have directed this. So I lived a semi-clandestine life. Other journalists lent me their computers. I tended to operate more by night than by day. Eventually, I gained confidence and started going out in full view. I was not rearrested. But in the meantime, I'd had some conversations with the Director General of Information, who was a very unpleasant man indeed. He'd been the principal enforcer under Saddam, as far as the press was concerned. And I think he had understood by that time that power was shifting. I mean, I personally have no power, but by this time they began to understand that people like me had also, you know, we had the American forces advancing fast on Baghdad, and that power would shift and that they would be accountable. And so this opened up new opportunities for us, and that carried me through until the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force arrived at the Palestine Hotel on the afternoon of April 9, and they pulled the statue down. And I say without any apology that it was my liberation too. I think there's a point at which nonpartisanship, neutrality, if you will, becomes a delusion. The fact is that we, not just me, but others, were very much endangered in the dying days of the Saddam regime, as were, by the way, the Iraqi people for 24 years. And when we saw those tanks arrive, I was going to say with the flags flying, they didn't actually have any flags flying, but when we saw the stars and stripes on the shoulders of the officers who entered the Palestine Hotel, I have to say it was a very emotional moment for me.
My guest is John Burns. He's the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. We'll talk more about Iraq after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Burns is my guest. He's the chief foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He covered the bombing of Iraq. He was there months before the bombing started. He returned to the States in early May. He went back to Iraq in November. He's in New York very briefly. Tonight he accepts an award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. One of the issues facing the United States now is how much debathification to try to put through in Iraq. How much should the new Iraq be purged of officials who worked under Saddam Hussein's regime? I'm wondering if there's any parables from your own experience that relate to that. Did you ever see any of these guys again, any of the thugs or the information of ministry people?
I did. I went to see the Director General of Information, the man who had been the enforcer and the oppressor. I felt, to be honest with you, I felt very sorry for him. He had gone into hiding. He was with his weeping wife and his late teenage son in an upper room in a building with no power. They had practically nothing to eat. And a colleague who went with me took the view that this was a thoroughly deserved fate. This man had been senior enough that he'd headed the Iraqi intelligence service in Western Europe for several years, from the late 80s on until he was expelled from Paris in the early 90s. And he had been very unpleasant indeed to a number of us. And I went to see him. I think I went to see him because I wanted release from a lifetime of hating him, or at least loathing him for some of the things that he had done. And I felt it would be better for me to meet him and to ask him how much he'd had to do with what they did to me. You know, hatred and loathing is a corrupting thing. He told me then that not only was I not your principal oppressor, but for me, he said, you would not have survived that incident. He said, when you spoke to Muthanna and you told him that his name, Muthanna's name, was known to people in New York and Washington, and that he would end up at the end of a rope if they did anything to you, he said, I told him that was correct. I told him that he should leave you there. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I never will know if it's true or not, but to tell you the truth, I want to believe it. I don't hate Uday al-Tahi, the former director general of the information ministry. He's a corrupt man. He was an opportunist. I don't want to excuse anything that he did, and I've no doubt that he was a party, if not directly, indirectly, to lots of people going to the gallows, as many senior officials of that regime were. I don't like piling on, as they say in rugby, and I would rather meet all that happened to me, which is, by the way, only a fraction of what happened to Iraqis under this regime. I'm sitting here in New York perfectly healthy. And as you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis went to their graves under this regime. I just feel it's better to purge that from my own soul, if you will.
Well, what has this led you to think about de-Ba'athification in Iraq?
I think it's a big problem for the United States with the collapse in administration that occurred during the period of looting and lawlessness. They've got to construct a new government from the ground up. And at the same time, the Iraqi people will not tolerate the reappointment of people who they know or suspect have been involved in the repression. How do you, as an American administrator, distinguish one from the other, especially when you're relying on Iraqis who may themselves be partisan to do it? It's a really difficult thing to do. And a lot of the Ba'athis have, as I read in a story in my own newspaper the other day by Susan Sachs, have been busy demoting themselves, or were busy demoting themselves before the American troops arrived. That's to say, going into the records, the files, changing the files, and demoting themselves from general to private. This is a really difficult issue.
Speaking of the Information of Ministry, there's an interview with you in a new book called Embedded, which is a series of interviews with journalists who covered the war in Iraq. One of the things you say in this interview is that during the bombing, you had gotten word from the New York Times that one of the targets for bombing that day or the next was the Information of Ministry. And you warned a lot of people who worked there to get out. These people were not your friends, and they certainly weren't the allies of America. Why did you do that?
Well, if I can summarize the story very quickly. I did get a call from New York on the basis of information passed from Washington that the Information Ministry was going to be hit in the next 24 hours. We were anchored to the Information Ministry by a Saddam rule that we could only use our satellite transmitters and telephones from the ministry. On pain, they said, of death were we to be discovered with secret satellite equipment outside of the ministry, which we all did. I literally buried one of my sat phones. I hid another one in a ventilation grill in a hotel. Anyway, suffice it to say, I got this call and I asked the editor of the paper, is this information for me only? And he said no such stipulation was placed on this. That is to say, the information that the ministry is going to be hit and destroyed by, as it turned out, cruise missiles. I decided that were I just to go floor to floor and tell the journalists in the Palestine Hotel that this was going to happen, it would leave me open to an Iraqi charge of causing alarm and despondency in a time of war, and they could shoot me. So I decided to do what I thought was the responsible thing, and I asked to see the information minister in the middle of the night. Eventually, the director general turned up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I told him what I knew. He asked me how I knew it, and I said, I suppose there are people in Washington who are friendly to me in one way or another, or maybe simply they feel that I'm a reliable conduit for this information. You've got to get everybody out of the building. I'll see what I can do, he said. And for 24 hours, he did absolutely nothing. There was a big sandstorm. The strike did not take place. I got another call from New York saying that Washington has said, don't be fooled. They haven't struck the building only because the sandstorm confuses satellite-guided weaponry, and they will destroy it. And so at that point, I went to the ministry. I went to all the TV stand-up positions on the mezzanine roof of the ministry and told all the crews. It was 7 or 8 at night, cold and wind-whipped, and there were not many Westerners there, and I told them to get off as fast as possible. And I went floor to floor within the ministry, and there weren't a lot of Iraqis there either. Most of them didn't speak English. And so I said, boom, boom, get out of here. Get out of here now. And in the end, when the missiles did strike that night, there was only one person lightly injured. Now, I don't think that had a lot to do with me, because I think that people realized that this ministry was going to go one way or the other. So there was only a skeleton staff there. But the downstream consequence of it for me was that when they came for me, the intelligence people, on the night of April the 1st, they cited this incident as proof that I was CIA, that I knew where the targeting was going. And I have to say, I'm glad they made that allegation, because in a situation which was inherently rather frightening, it so angered me that they would turn truth on its head in this way that it emboldened me to strike back, and it emboldened me to say to them, you don't seem to understand the realities here. American troops are less than 100 miles away. They are going to occupy this city. Power has already slipped from your hands. Think about what you're doing. So the absurdity and deviousness of this charge enraged me.
Knowing how your attempt to save people at the Information of Ministry was used against you and you were charged with being a CIA agent, Would you have done it again?
Oh God, I hope so. I don't think until the moment comes just how brave you'll be. My father was a fighter pilot during the Second World War, and he used to talk about this a great deal and how difficult it was to tell who had the guts at the critical moments to do the right thing at, you know, potentially terminal cost. To say that you would know that you would do the right thing anyway, even if it meant being taken away to the gallows, would be a pretty pretentious thing to say, because, you know, I've just not been in that place. Like all of us, I would hope that I would do the right thing. You know, it's a far, far better thing I do, etc. But whether I would or not, I don't know. I have been seriously frightened in my life. I know how it changes behavior and how you sometimes fail your own, you know, better instincts. So I just don't know what the answer to that is.
My guest is John Burns, the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. We'll talk more about Iraq after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Burns, the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. You're in New York right now to accept an award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. As we mentioned, you covered the bombing of Iraq. You were there months before that. You left in early May. You returned again in early November, and we'll go back at the end of the week. During part of the time that you were back in the States, in between being in Iraq, you were on a sick leave. What was the problem?
Curious business this. Most of us were under pretty terrific pressure in Baghdad. I stayed on for about 6 weeks after the war ended, and then I left, and I called my wife from the border as I was crossing back into the other world and told her that I'd never been so happy in my life to get away from the place. I felt terrific. And within half an hour, I didn't feel terrific. And by the time I got to Heathrow, I felt very unterrific indeed. And she took me straight to a public hospital where I spent some time, where they diagnosed a case of heart arrhythmia. I have to say immediately that this is an extremely common thing. Millions of people, millions of Americans have this problem. It's the broken ankle of the heart business. The most common cause is stress. And I saw a number of cardiologists as we looked for a fix for this, which we eventually found, I'm glad to say. Eventually I found myself sitting talking to a man who called himself the electrician, a specialist in the electricity of the heart. And he had a report from another cardio saying, you know, this chap's been endured cruise missiles and, you know, arrest by the secret police in Iraq and one thing and another. So it's not surprising that this would happen. This fellow looked at me and he said, tell me something, what were you eating in Baghdad during all of this? And I said, there wasn't a lot to eat. It's good for me because I need to lose the weight. What were you drinking? And I said, well, I'm not a drinker. I had a couple of vodkas now and then, and that's about it. So I was drinking tea. How much tea? He said. And I said, oh, 25 or 30 cups a day. And he put a big line through the report that said cruise missile, secret police. And he said, my friend, he's an Irishman. He said, my friend, he said, if you had been a bank manager sitting right here, this conversation took place in England, he said, you'd be here right now. That amount of caffeine is one of the most reliable triggers for heart arrhythmia. It never struck me that tea could be an addictive, that it could be a narcotic in effect. The problem is, if you work for the New York Times, you're working as a foreign correspondent, you're working hours and hours ahead of New York, which means working deep into the night. The first edition time for the New York Times in New York is something like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning in Baghdad. And I was responsible at that time for running our operations there, so I never got to bed before about 6 and then slept for 2 or 3 hours. And the tea kept me going. And to tell you, a life without tea, would it be worth living? I'm not sure. So I made a compromise with the electrician. He said 3 cups a day. I kind of double that, and everything seems to be fine.
What stories are you going to be working on when you go back to Iraq?
Well, you know, we are driven by the winds as to what we do. You wake up, you know, with a hotel being rocketed, all plans go out the door. But in general, we've got to answer the big questions for Americans if we possibly can. Of course, we can't, but we go as far as we can. We have to tell Americans whether this is a doable enterprise. Are these young men, young American men, dying for any achievable purpose? That's what we have to do. And I have a particular interest in trying to connect the past to the present. That's to say, you know, it's one thing to say that a lot has gone wrong since April. But I think it's necessary, essential, to measure all of this against what went before. To put it at its bluntest, it's true that something over, I think now, in the region of 200 American troops have died, perhaps a little bit more, since May. And that is an absolutely unbearable tragedy for each family. You know, I have a son of military age, and I can't imagine what it must be like to bear that. But it's worth thinking also that if you multiplied the number of Americans who have died by 5 for the number of Iraqis who have died, or even 10, and then you think back to what the situation was a year ago, it's a society where, according to human rights reports, on one day in, I think, 1999, Saddam executed 2,000 people. If the only measure you took of this was human life, it's a pretty important measure, then I don't think it would be easy to conclude that things are worse now than they were before. Freedom has a price. It's a very expensive thing, freedom. It's going to take a lot of time for the Iraqis to adjust to it. Will America bear that? How long is America prepared to see this through? I don't know, but I think our job in Iraq is not to be polemical, but simply to help the American readership reach its own conclusions about this.
Well, listen, I wish you good health and safe travels, and I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you, and congratulations on your award this evening.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
John Burns is the New York Times chief foreign correspondent. Tonight he receives the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. He'll return to Iraq by the end of the week.